Thanks, Alana. Thanks, Rob and Glenn. That was great. So next, we're going to go on to look at the corporate items, both the income statement and the balance sheet. And the balance sheet. And for that, we're going to go to Crystal Prestai. And Crystal, over to you.
Thanks, Fraser, and good morning, everyone. My presentation is going to focus on income statement items that are presented below gross profit, with the exception of income taxes, which will be covered by Thomas Chung. I'm also going to do a refresh on how QB2 is presented in our financial statements, now that we've had almost a year of reporting QB2 subsequent to the partnering transaction with Sumitomo Metal Mining and Sumitomo Corporation. So turning over to slide 3, you can see the agenda for my section. We have green boxes around the items that I'll cover in my presentation. As you can see, everything sort of below gross profit. I'm going to provide you with an overview about how you can think about modeling some of these other operating and financing costs, focusing the discussion particularly on other operating income and expense, with modeling of settlement pricing adjustments, modeling stock-based compensation to the extent possible, and then I'll take you through the finance expense and the go-forward composition, including QB2 capitalized interest. And as I mentioned at the end, I'll take you through the QB2 presentation of financial information throughout our various financial statements. I would note, before I get started, we are reviewing how we present our adjusted earnings calculation, and we may be making some changes to that going forward. On slide 4, you can see a summary of the last 5 years and the 5-year average of our general and administration, exploration, research and innovation, and asset impairment line items. From a modeling perspective, our general and administration costs include our Vancouver head office and offices that we have in various locations, including Santiago, Calgary, Spokane, and Beijing. For G&A costs, a reasonable basis to consider in your model would look something like the 2018 spending, not as low as the average of the last 5 years, but not as high as 2019, particularly in light of our cost reduction program. For exploration costs, using the 5-year average, it's relatively consistent with the last 2 years and a reasonable basis for you to be thinking about modeling going forward. Research and innovation costs includes our Race 21 spending that is not capital in nature, as in it doesn't go on our balance sheet, as well as some other research and innovation costs that we have relating to water and our technical services function. 2019 is a good basis for modeling that line item going forward, but I would encourage you to look to our Race 21 guidance that we provided at the end of 2019, and that will be updated on a quarterly basis going forward. Just to ensure you're picking up that piece correctly. Asset impairments, obviously not an item that can be modeled, and any impairments that we have or reversals of those impairments are included in our adjusted earnings calculation. Moving to slide 9, you can see there an excerpt of our other operating income and expense financial statement note from our 2019 annual financial statements. This is a financial statement note that we include every quarter. It contains consistent information, so you can see the same breakdown by line item in our financial statement notes. And of the items noted on the slide, I'm going to speak in more detail to the settlement pricing adjustments and how you can think about those after Mike's presentation. And then on the share-based compensation, I'll provide more detail and take you through, lastly, the general items. And again, as I mentioned at the beginning, we are reviewing how we present our adjusted earnings calculation. We may make some changes to the calculation going forward, and some of the items that I speak to are already currently adjusted in that calculation. On slide 6, you will see we provided you with a simplified settlement pricing adjustment model. We present this each quarter for your reference, and encourage you to refer to that when you're thinking about settlement pricing adjustments. But just to add a bit more to Mike's presentation and give you a bit further context as to why we have pricing adjustments and how they're presented. And then I'll take you through some things to think about if you're trying to model and not using our simplified model on the graph there. As Mike mentioned, we do issue a provisional invoice on our concentrate sale. They are priced 2 to 3 months after the sale. Typically, we would recognize revenue on concentrate loading based on a forward price at that date. We don't adjust our revenue subsequent to that date. It's locked in. Any change in the price between that provisional invoice and settlement, those are mark-to-market adjustments. We record them in our other operating income and expense as settlement pricing adjustments. Each quarter, we disclose the volume of unpriced metal concentrates for copper and zinc to enable you to model the price adjustments. You'll need to look at the change in price from the end of the last period to the end of the current period and apply that to those outstanding volumes. There will be some variance you won't be able to capture as a result of timing of the sales and the settlements and the fluctuation of prices during the period. Typically, that won't be significant unless there is a lot of price volatility like we are seeing in the month of March. But using the information we provide in our disclosure should give you a reasonable basis to model on, and you can confirm that against the simplified model that we're showing on the slide there. On slide 7, we have also included a simplified model for you to think about when you're trying to model our share-based compensation to try to make it less complicated. It is a difficult thing to model, but we do provide information in our disclosures should you want to go into the detail of doing the calculations yourself. We have two types of share-based compensation to consider, stock options and share units. And within share units, we have DSUs, RSUs, PSUs, and PDSUs. When you're thinking about stock options, the stock compensation expense is determined per option on grant using a Black-Scholes calculation, and it's recognized evenly over the vesting period of 36 months. This is a fairly steady number. It's around $4 to $5 million a quarter or $15 to $20 million a year. Modeling of the compensation expense relating to the different types of units is more complicated because there is a vesting component as well as a mark-to-market component based on our share price. In our financial statements, on an annual basis, we do provide you with the vested and unvested units and the vesting periods, and you can look to the share price at each period end to estimate should you want to go into that detail. On a quarterly basis, we also provide you with information on grants and grant prices and vesting and Black-Scholes information as well in our equity note to our financial statements. Otherwise, the simplified model on the slide will provide you with a reasonable estimate to use if you don't want to go into all of that other detail. Turning to slide 8, the items listed comprise the remainder of that other operating income and expense line on the income statement. For each line item, there is information on these items by year on the slide, as well as a driver to assist you in modeling these items where possible. So I'll take you through each of these items listed there, starting with environmental costs. This includes the cost of remediation work for our closed operations, and it also includes the change in our decommissioning liabilities for these sites relating to the quarterly change in the discount rate that we use to discount these liabilities. So in periods where you see larger expenses on that slide, these arise as a result of changes in the discount rate and increases in expected costs of ongoing remediation work at our closed operations. We are reviewing this item for possible adjustment in our adjusted earnings calculation going forward. Care and maintenance costs, as you can see on the slide, they increased in 2019. That was as a result of the closure of Ponderay and Coal Mountain during 2019, as Ryan mentioned. With these operations closed for the full year in 2020, as well as the closure of Cardinal River in the third quarter of 2020, we can expect that these costs will increase in 2020. So as we go through the year in 2020, that will be a reasonable estimate for you to use in modeling going forward. But 2019 with some increase is a good proxy for going forward rather than using 2018 or years prior to that. Social responsibility and donations, that's generally a steady amount. You can use 2019 as a basis for that. Gains and losses on sale of assets, we adjust for that in our adjusted earnings calculation currently, so there's nothing for you to consider in your models there. Commodity derivatives, this relates to our zinc and lead forward swap program that we have in place and is intended to match the shipping season and seasonality of sales at Red Dog. It also includes an embedded derivative that we have in our road and port contract at Red Dog that's connected to the zinc price. All of these items fluctuate with commodity prices, both lead and zinc, and difficult to model, and is something we are considering in our adjusted earnings calculation going forward. Take-or-pay contract costs, those relate to the QB2 power purchase agreement. You can use 2019 as a proxy for modeling. And then the last two lines there, Waneta Dam sale, obviously that was a one-off item in 2018, and so nothing for you to model there. And the other line tends to be fairly steady, so you can use an average or 2019 as your basis for modeling. On slide 9, you can see an excerpt of our finance expense note disclosure from our Q4 2019 financial statements that gives you a breakdown of our finance expense. This note is included in our quarterly financial statements each quarter for your reference. And I'm going to take you through how you can think about this expense line in three different buckets: interest on borrowings, general items, and capitalized borrowing costs. But before I move into the modeling aspects, I just wanted to note a few things here on the balances just for your reference. Debt interest decreased significantly in 2019 as a result of the reduction in our outstanding notes with the redemption of the 8.5% notes back in June of 2019. You can see the interest in 2019 showing on the advances from Sumitomo Metal Mining and Sumitomo Corporation, referred to as SMM/SC on the slide. These do not eliminate on consolidation, and the interest is recorded there in finance expense. Going forward, the interest on the QB2 project financing will also be included. Interest on lease liabilities also increased in 2019. That was a result of the adoption of the new lease accounting standard under IFRS on January 1st, 2019. There was no restatement required of prior periods, so you can see the increase there, and that's the reason for that. I'm now going to go into the various buckets to give you a bit more detail on how you can think about them from a modeling perspective. Starting on slide 10 with interest on borrowings, here we have outlined the driver of each of the categories of interest on borrowings and the source of the information that you need to model these items, all available within our financial statements. Starting with debt interest, for your reference, our weighted average interest rate on borrowings was about 5.9% at the end of 2019. That's information that we disclose again in our financial statement notes. Our debt outstanding is also outlined in our financial statement notes in the debt note. It's broken down by the various debt maturities that we have. So you can look to that for the debt outstanding, multiply that by the rate, and that will give you your debt interest information. The advances from SMM and SC, that is its own line on our balance sheet, so you can look to that for the balance outstanding. And the interest is calculated at LIBOR plus a margin of approximately 3%. And so, again, you can check your calculation against the finance expense that's been recognized to see if you're in a reasonable range. Interest on our lease liabilities can be modeled using information in our leases note and our finance expense note, again, to check your calculations in our financial statement information. Beginning in Q1 of 2020, you will find the details of the QB2 project financing in our debt note, including the amount outstanding. And as noted on the slide, the rate to consider there is LIBOR plus a margin of about 1.6% annually. On slide 11, you can see the general items included in our finance expense and how you can think about each of these items. For letters of credit, if you were to go back on slide 9, I should have mentioned this, letters of credit and standby fees decreased significantly in 2019. This was a result of our return to investment grade credit ratings and the release of a number of the letters of credit we had against our power purchase contracts and against some transportation services agreements. So 2019 is a better proxy for modeling the letters of credit and standby fees going forward, rather than looking at years prior to that when we were not investment grade. Accretion on our DRP liabilities, that's driven by the discount rate on our decommissioning liabilities. It's outlined in our provisions note to the annual financial statements. You can find that information there. And then both interest on our retirement benefit plans and the other line item within finance expense are not material for you to think about in your modeling. On slide 12, the last component of our finance expense is an offset to finance expense and relates to our capitalized borrowing costs. If you look to the trend on the bars on the right side of the slide, you can see that through 2016 and 2017 and into the first half of 2018, we had an increase in the amount of borrowing costs capitalized. And that relates to the Fort Hills project construction, where we had commercial production on June 1st of 2018. And then you can see the drop off in the third quarter of 2018 and then starting to ramp up from there with the sanctioning of QB2 in the fourth quarter of 2019, or sorry, of 2018. And so going forward, the largest component of our capitalized borrowing costs will obviously be on the QB2 spending. And as mentioned in our investor presentation yesterday, there is about $3.9 billion U.S. remaining on QB2 spending, in addition to amounts already capitalized that we use for our borrowing cost calculation. All of the project financing, interest and interest on the advances from SMM and SC are capitalized, and then a portion of our other debt interest would also be capitalized. If you're thinking about that calculation, you take the total capitalized amount for QB2 times the weighted average borrowing rate disclosed in our annual financial statements. As I mentioned previously, it's about 5.9% at December 31st, 2019. That will give you the QB2 portion. We are currently capitalizing approximately $65 million of borrowing costs on QB2 each quarter, and I expect that will increase by around $10 million a quarter through 2020 for QB2. The net finance expense on our income statement will remain fairly constant as the project financing interest will be fully capitalized. And the borrowing cost rate of capitalization, just want to note, will decrease once we hit commercial production of QB2. This commercial production date is as defined under IFRS, so it is not necessarily first production, but it's when we have the asset available for use as intended by management, which will be disclosed at some point in the future. In addition to QB2 capitalized interest, you should add around 10 to 15 million Canadian of interest capitalization a quarter relating to our other capital projects. Turning over now to slide 13, you'll see an excerpt of our non-operating income and expense note. The items on this slide and in this line item on our income statement are items that are typically adjusted for in our adjusted earnings calculation, including foreign exchange, gains and losses that we may have on any debt redemptions. Previously, we had a revaluation of a debt prepayment option. We no longer have that. That related to our 8.5% notes that have been redeemed. So that should have a nil balance for the foreseeable future. The other line item includes the remeasurement of the Anami dividend liability, which I'll speak to when I go through the QB2 section. So those line items, there's not really anything for you to think about from a modeling perspective. We do largely eliminate those in adjusted earnings. So finally, I'm going to do a quick refresh now on how QB2 is presented in our financial statements following the partnering transaction with Sumitomo Metal Mining and Sumitomo Corporation. This presentation has been included in our financial statements since Q1 of 2019 when the transaction closed. So it's a good time now to do a recap after a year of having this presented in our financial statements. So starting on slide 15, just as a reminder before I take you through this, we did conclude on the closing of the partnering transaction that we still retained control over QBSA. So that means we continue to consolidate 100% of QB2 in our financial statements. On the balance sheet, we've only shown the liabilities and equity aspects because that's where there are more relevant items for you to think about. But on the asset side of things, what I would note is that we do include 100% of the project spending within our property, plant, and equipment balance on the balance sheet. And if you are looking for our share of spending and amounts net of project financing, we do provide this disclosure in our MD&A each quarter. So I'd encourage you to look there for that detail. It will be found in our capital expenditures section of the MD&A. So turning over back to that same slide, looking at the liabilities and equity, 100% of the project financing will be presented within our debt line. It won't be its own line on the balance sheet, but you will be able to find details in our debt note to the financial statement starting in Q1 of 2020. And again, I'd refer you back to the MD&A disclosure if you're looking for our share of spending in 2020. The advances from SMM and SC, as I mentioned, are shown as their own line. These are not eliminated on consolidation. They are external loans, so they are presented separately and not within our debt balance. The shareholder loans that Teck makes down into QBSA are eliminated. These are considered intercompany loans, and so on consolidation, they don't show up on our external financial statements. SMM and SC's cumulative interest is shown as a component of our equity. It's referred to as attributable to non-controlling interest. We do have other entities that we do not own 100% of, so this is not exclusively the SMM-SC interest, but the majority of the balance is. And if you're looking for more details, I would refer you to the non-controlling interest financial statement note in our annual 2019 financial statement. That will give you the split of non-controlling interest relating to our other entities. On slide 16, you can see the income statement. We will pick up 100% of the revenues and expenses for QB2 once operational. And Sumitomo and Enami's share of the profit will be shown at the bottom of the income statement as flagged in that green square box. Turning to slide 17, you can see the various items on our cash flow statement and how they'll be presented once QB2 is operational and how the funding and spending is reflected at this time. Within operating activities, 100% of the profit will be shown there along with depreciation once we are operational. 100% of project spending is shown in investing activities. Again, I would draw your attention to the MD&A disclosures in our capital expenditures table for a breakdown of what our cash funding is on a net basis. And then lastly, in the financing activities, you can see 100% of advances and equity contributions and repayments are presented in each separate line item labeled accordingly, so you can find that information there. And then the last slide for me, slide 18, just to give you a quick refresh of Enami's ownership interest in QB. Many of you will be aware of this. This slide was presented in our investor decks when we sanctioned the project back in December of 2018. Enami owns a 10% non-funding interest in CMT-QB. They do not fund QB2 development costs. They are entitled to board representation. Until shareholder loans are fully repaid to SMM, SC, and Teck, Enami is entitled to a minimum dividend based on net income that approximates 2 to 2.5% of free cash flow. Thereafter, Enami receives 10% of dividends and free cash flow. We do record the discounted value of this dividend as a liability on our balance sheet. We do remeasure it when there are significant changes in the inputs that drive the amount payable, like the copper price and interest rates on the shareholder loan. So that's something that we adjust for. As I mentioned, it's presented in non-operating income and expense. And that's everything for me. I'm happy to take any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Once again, please press star 1 at this time. If you have a question, the first question is from Tony Robson with Global Mining Research. Please go ahead.
Sorry, I actually withdrew my question. Hit star 2 because it did not work. Apologies. I have no question.
I apologize. Thank you. Once again, please press star 1 at this time if you have a question. There are no questions registered at this time, so I will turn the meeting back over to Mr. Phillips.
Okay. Thanks, Lana. And thanks, Crystal. That was great. So that brings us to our final section, and that is income and resource taxes. And for that, we're going to turn to Thomas Chung. Thomas, over to you.
Good morning, everyone. My pleasure to be here. I'll begin on slide 3, income and resource taxes. In my presentation today, I will first provide you with a basic overview of the tax regimes, including the effective tax rates on operating profits in each jurisdiction that we operate in. After that, I will discuss the main influences on our overall effective tax rate, illustrating how the distribution of operating profits in each jurisdiction contributes to the overall effective tax rate for Teck as a whole. I make a distinction between tax on operating profit versus on net profit. This is because items below operating profit, such as finance and non-operating expenses, are generally tax-affected at a lower rate, as these items are not deductible in computing resource taxes. Later, I will highlight how in times of lower operating margins, relative to our finance and non-operating expenses, our effective tax rate may skew upwards, possibly to extreme proportions. Tech provides us general guidance for modeling purposes in a normal operating environment, an overall annual effective tax rate between 35% and 37% on net profit. This range comprises both income and resource taxes. Please note that while this is our annual guidance, quarterly results may fluctuate outside of this range. I'm now on slide 4, Canadian tax in 2020. This is a quick snapshot of the corporate tax regime we have in Canada. For our BC coal and copper mining business, the all-in effective tax rate is about 36.5%. Note that resource taxes, such as the BC mineral tax, is deductible for income tax purposes. This is the point that I'll come back to, in that it's generally true for all the countries we operate in, resource taxes paid are deductible for income tax purposes. For our energy and trail operations, the effective tax rate is only the Canadian corporate income tax rate of 27%. This is because there is no resource tax applicable to these operations. This is also the rate applicable to finance and non-operating expenses, as these are not deductible for resource taxes. On capital gains from one-off transactions, such as from the sale of the Juanita Dam in 2018, only half of the gain is taxable, hence the effective tax rate is 13.5%. As our Canadian operation is significant relative to the rest of our worldwide operations, you can see how our tax rate guidance generally reflects these rates. We're now on slide 5, Canadian income tax pools. As you are aware, we regularly note in our MD&A that we are currently not cash taxable for income tax purposes in Canada. This is the case because of the very significant income tax pools we have as highlighted on this slide. First, we have net operating losses, which can be written off immediately against any income or gains. Next, we have Canadian development expenditures, which can be deducted at 30% per annum on a declining balance basis. Lastly, we also have allowable capital losses that can be used only against capital gains. In 2018, we were able to use capital losses to shelter a significant portion of our capital gain on the sale of Juanita without utilizing too much of our net operating losses or other tax pools. I'm on slide 6, BC mineral tax. The BCMT is a two-tier tax system calculated on a mine-by-mine basis. The first tier is a minimum 2% tax on net current proceeds, which is generally our gross profits. The second tier is a maximum 13% tax on net revenues, which is the tax on the excess of cumulative revenues over cumulative operating and capital costs. In other words, after all costs are recovered. The first-tier tax is creditable against second-tier tax, and we effectively pay at the higher of the two taxes. For all our operating BC mines, we're currently in the 13% tax regime. Finance and non-operating expenses are deductible for BC mineral tax purposes, and for financial statement or accounting purposes, we treat BCMT as an income tax expense. I'm on slide 7. The Alberta oil sands royalty, which applies to our Fort Hills mine. Similar to the BC mineral tax, this is a two-tier or two-phase system with a minimum pre-payout royalty on gross revenues and a maximum post-payout royalty on net revenues after recovery of operating capital costs. Fort Hills is currently in the pre-payout phase. The royalty is calculated on a progressive linear scale based on WTI prices in the range noted. Any royalties paid is deductible for income tax purposes. Note, however, that for financial statements or accounting purposes, this royalty is not treated as income tax expense, but is netted against revenues. I'm now on slide 8, Peruvian tax in 2020. The applicable corporate tax rate on earnings is 29.5%, with a withholding tax on any dividends paid at 5%. Turning to Peruvian resource taxes, there are two. the special mining tax, and the modified mining royalty, which are applicable to our Antamina mine. Both are computed on the same progressive sliding scale on operating margin. On a combined basis, these taxes start at 3% on the first 10% of operating margin, and then the rate increases at every 5% increment of operating margin, topping out at 20.4%. For new projects, such as Zafanal, one can apply for a tax stability agreement with the Peruvian government to stabilize the income tax rate up to 15 years. However, the stabilized rate will be at 2% premium, or 31.5%. I'm now on slide 9, Chilean taxes. There are corporate income taxes at two levels. The first level tax is 27% on taxable income. The second level tax, also known as withholding tax, is 8%, and it's also computed on the same base as the first level tax, making the total taxes on full repatriation of Chilean earnings at 35%. As a footnote, however, for financial statement purposes, we have not been accruing withholding taxes, as we expect to be reinvesting our earnings in Chile in the foreseeable future. However, for modeling purposes, you may wish to consider this. The specific mining royalty is calculated on operating margin based on a progressive sliding scale. It starts at 5% for the first 35% in operating margin, and then increases at each 5% increment, topping out at 14% overall. The special mining royalty is treated as income tax expense for financial statement purposes. I'm on slide 10, U.S. tax in 2020. For our Red Dog mine, the combined statutory federal and Alaska state corporate income tax rate is 25%. However, due to special income tax deductions, namely the percentage depletion allowance and the FDII deduction, our U.S. income tax burden is much lower. The percentage depletion allowance is calculated at 22% on adjusted net revenues, capped at 50% of taxable income. The new FDII deduction is an export incentive that effectively reduces the federal tax on portions of our profit from export sales of Red Dog concentrate. The withholding tax rate on dividends paid out of the U.S. is 5%. The Alaska mining license tax is based on 7% of operating profit, and is also eligible for a similar percentage depletion allowance. This mining license tax is deductible for income tax purposes and is treated as income tax expense for financial statement purposes. On page, or slide 11, we have a simplified illustration of U.S. taxes in 2020. As you can see on the right column, the all-in effective tax rate on repatriated U.S. earnings is 22%. I'm now on slide 12. Here I am summarizing all the applicable effective statutory tax rates on operating profit in each jurisdiction we operate in. As you can see, we have a wide range of effective tax rates, which, depending on our distribution of operating profits across these jurisdictions for any given quarter or year, our overall consolidated effective tax rates can fluctuate. In a normal operating environment, we expect the weighted average annual rate on operating profit to be around 34% to 36%. I'm on slide 13. Using the effective statutory tax rates from the previous slide, I will now illustrate using these two scenarios how our overall consolidated effective tax rate on operating profit is influenced by the distribution of operating profits. You can see that it produces a range of 34% to 36% on a weighted average basis under these two scenarios. The way to look at this table is under each column or operations, multiply the statutory tax rate, which is A, by the assumed percentage of operating profit or loss, which is B1. The consolidated column to the far right is the weighted average of all of these separate jurisdictional tax rates. As you can see, depending on the distribution of profits or loss, the overall consolidated effective tax rate can range from 34% to 36%, and sometimes outside of this range in a particular quarter. I'm now on slide 14. This slide illustrates the relationship between different operating profit levels, finance and non-operating expenses, and our overall effective tax rate on net profits. As our heading suggests, and also illustrated on the chart to the right, the general rule is that our overall effective tax rate on net profit rises as operating profit falls. Assume that our effective tax rate on operating profit is taxed at 35%. This is the range from the previous slide. In scenario one, even at high operating margins, finance and non-operating expenses can skew our rates upward by at least 1%. You can see the effective tax rate flatten out at about 36% as we go from low to higher levels of operating profits. However, at lower operating margins, such as in scenario two and three, we see the effective tax rate skew upwards in a very steep manner. Slide 15 is our last slide. Coming back to our general guidance for an annual overall effective tax rate for tech, here is a chart showing what our actual overall effective tax rate has been for the past 4 years on normalized net profit. After adjusting for non-recurring unusual items, such as the Oneida dam sale in 2018, which was subject to a lower capital gains tax rate, and a significant impairments in 2019, largely in our energy BU, we see that our overall effective tax rate has been consistently around 36%. This chart also shows what, for the past 4 years, what our current tax rate has been, ranging from 19% to 33%, and on the average, about 25%. This concludes my presentation today, and I will try to answer any of your questions.
Thank you. Once again, please press star 1 at this time if you have a question. Again, as a reminder, you may press star 1 at this time if you have a question. There are no questions registered at this time, so I will turn the meeting back over to Mr. Phillips.
Okay, so that does take us through the presentations. Thanks to Thomas for the last one and to all the presenters. We certainly have time if anybody does have any additional questions. We could pull one more time on any of the subjects. As everyone's on, we'd be happy to take them. Why don't you just check one more time, Elena?
Certainly. So once again, please press star 1 at this time if you have a question. And we do have a question from Carlos de Alba from Morgan Stanley. Please go ahead.
Great. Thank you. I just wanted to refer back to slide 15 of the corporate slides, the corporate income statement and balance sheet items that Crystal presented. On that slide, there are two line items for the Sumitomo participation in QB2. One is advances, and the other is on liabilities, and the other is on equity, the Sumitomo interest, equity interest. How can we differentiate those? So more precisely, are all future contributions from Sumitomo going to be considered as advances? I'm just a little bit confused there.
Sorry, Fraser, do you want to take that one?
Nope, go ahead.
Okay, I was just going to say that, no, they will be coming, the funding coming through from SMM and SC will be split between loans and equity contributions going forward. I don't have that split off of the top of my head, but we can get it through Fraser's team to circulate back out to you. And so you will be able to see those items split going forward.
All right. So some of the money will add?
Carlos, it'll depend on the it depends on the FinCap rules in Chile. So about ultimately, and we will check the exact split, but ultimately you're limited to 75% debt. So you have to put in 25% in equity and 75% in debt in terms of any advances that are put down into the operating entity, either by ourselves or Sumitomo.
Okay. And I guess you were going to try to maximize up to the 70%. Those will be incurring interest expenses for QB2 legal entity in the future and being paid back to the equity partners, correct?
Yes. So anything that's any of the advances of Sumitomo and ourselves are essentially interest bearing loans.
Right. Okay. Although your part of it gets eliminated in consolidation. Okay. Got it. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you. The next question is from Brian MacArthur with Raymond James. Please go ahead.
Good morning. I have two questions. I guess my first one is for tax. Just looking at deferred taxes versus current taxes, is there any way you can give us a better guidance going forward of exactly what you think a good deferred tax rate? I mean, I get it. It depends on which country you're in, but is there any more guidance you can just give on that? Because if you show on slide 16, it does move around a fair bit, or slide 15.
Yeah, the best we can do is what I've shown you here, showing you what the average has been in the range. It's difficult to really predict the split between current and deferred taxes because deferred taxes are mainly on timing differences, and timing differences can vary from more than 1 year to 10, 20 years. So it's hard for us to give you kind of a composite kind of defined range. But what I can show you on this chart is that we do pay cash taxes for resource tax purposes, and that's mainly what we pay in Canada. And then in the other jurisdictions, we pay cash taxes for income and resource taxes.
Great, thank you. My other question goes back a little bit to Tony's question earlier on the coal, where we talked about 75-25 for the hard coking coal versus PCI and semi. Just going forward, once we get rid of Cardinal River, does that not change as you get more outfield material coming in?
Yeah, we will get a higher realized price for Alpheus hard coking coal versus Cardinal River, but we still recommend for modeling purposes to use 92% of the benchmark price.
It's also, Brian, that the split is a longer term split based on the 75% based on the reserves, and so you can see that some of the numbers that Ryan. As you already know, but some of those numbers that Ryan presented in terms of reserve life for Cardinal, you take Cardinal out, that, in terms of relative size, it's not going to change that calculation, or not much.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The next question is from Tony Robson with Global Mining Research. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my question again. In terms of your Canadian income tax pools, the accumulated losses, if you like, some companies refer, when they talk about a dollar figure, they talk about how much of, we're talking about pre-tax earnings that would shield. Some talk about the actual tax that would save. So the $2.6 billion, could you provide some clarity, please, on where you're talking about that's actually the tax that gets saved or the pre-tax income it shields? Thank you.
Thank you. That $2.6 billion is the amount of losses, and it's the pre-tax number.
Thank you. No further questions.
Thank you. And there are no further questions registered at this time, so I will turn the meeting back over to Mr. Phillips.
Okay. Thanks, Alana. And thanks again to all the presenters. And thank you to all of you for joining us. Hopefully, not an ideal format, obviously, but under the circumstances, hope you found it useful that the presentations are being recorded and they'll be up on the website along with the materials. You can refer to them there. And certainly, if you've got questions arising from this or more questions, don't hesitate to get in touch with either myself or Lori or Ellen. And we'd be happy to arrange to take you through some of this or answer any specific questions. So with that, thanks again. Stay safe and be healthy, and we'll talk to you all soon. Thanks very much.
Thank you. The conference has now ended. Please disconnect your lines at this time, and we thank you for your participation.